God, we come from our weeks living in a world which is scattered and jangled and pulled in all different directions. And we come and we remember what's true, but what we haven't fully experienced, and that's that you're knitting and weaving everything together to be whole again and putting Jesus over it all as the one who can do that. You're making all things one under him. And we need that. We need to be made whole. And our relationships need to be made whole. And when we get a glimpse of that, we just say holy. Because you are different. You are so far above us. And yet we're longing for you to draw us to you and draw us to one another to make things more whole in our lives, in our community, in our families. So we ask you to do that this morning. Our eyes are on you. Amen. Well, good morning, Regen. So good to be together. My name is Dick Wiedenheft. I get to be one of the leaders here at Regen as the lead pastor, and I would love to meet you if we haven't had a chance to meet yet. We are halfway through our series on parenting. And for those of you who aren't parents, thank you for hanging with us. We hope there's been some things along the way for you. Back when I was in seminary, Anne worked as a nanny. And she took care of three young girls during the day. Sometimes the mom was there with them. Sometimes the mom was off doing other things. And they were a great family, as families go. But like any family, they had their tough days. And one challenging day when nerves were frayed and people were cranky, the three-year-old, who was a very sensitive soul, said something that made Anne laugh. This little girl whined and said, "We are not a happy family." And that's sort of what today's sermon is about the environment in which we parent. The family environment that kids grow up in, are nurtured in, learn how to relate to others in, and learn how to be a little person in. And as we go through this series on parenting, we're looking at the book of 1 Corinthians for parenting insight. 1 Corinthians is a letter that the Apostle Paul, one of the pioneers of the Christian faith, wrote to a group of Jesus followers in a Greek city called Corinth. And today we're looking at one single sentence that Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15:33. He quotes a proverb. Now, this isn't a proverb that Paul came up with, and it's not a biblical proverb. Rather, it was actually a Greek proverb, which was there already rolling around in the broader culture. Because you see, the Bible isn't the only place that we can find wisdom. It's the best place, but it's not the only place. In fact, the book of Proverbs recognizes that God's wisdom, God's truth, is out there in the culture too. And as Proverbs puts it in Proverbs 1, verse 20, wisdom is crying in the streets. Wisdom is crying in the streets. And Paul recognizes this. He recognizes God's wisdom in this Greek proverb from his day, and so he includes it in Scripture, and so he elevates it to the status of God's authoritative word to us. Here it is: bad company corrupts good character. That's wisdom, right? Bad company corrupts good character. We might think of peer pressure if we hang around people who are encouraging us and pressuring us to do things we know are wrong. We're more likely over time to give in and start doing those things if we're feeling that pressure and that encouragement from our peers, because bad company corrupts good character. We could also think of just basic mimicking. We as humans, we just tend to mimic and pick up some of the habits and the mannerisms of those that we hang out with. Maybe you move to the South, and over time you start to pick up a slight Southern accent. Or you hang out with teenagers, and you pick up expressions and phrases that they use. Having teens has really expanded my vocabulary over the years. I've learned words like riz and slaps, and most recently, bruh. Or hang around with people and you start picking up their habits. Do they curse a lot? Maybe you start to get a little more colorful in your language. Do they talk down about their friends or maybe their spouse behind those people's backs? Maybe you find yourself joining in and doing the same. Do they gossip or complain a lot? Maybe you give in to those temptations more often. Bad company corrupts good character. If you're not a parent, then this is some really important wisdom for you personally. Even as an adult, think about the company that you keep. For good or bad, it will have an impact on your character over time. But what does this have to do with parenting? Well, here's the question I want to invite us to think about for those of us who are parents. What kind of company are we to our children? What kind of company are we for our kids? Because the kind of company that we are has a big impact on the kind of character our kids develop and the kind of people that they become. We looked at this somewhat last Sunday. We looked at the person of the parent, who we are as people. And so just to review, we talked about how we're models, how parents are examples to their kids. And that our kids are far more likely to grow up to do what we do and to become who we are than they are to do what we say. And we saw that there's actually a neurological brain mechanism for this, that when we face a situation that calls for a response, the right side of our brain flips through a catalog of past visual memories to see how other people have handled this kind of situation, how they've responded before. And the memories we're most interested in and most filtering for are based on what our people, the people we belong to, the people we're attached to, what they have done in situations like this before. So if our kids are well attached to us, then and if they feel that we're their people, then they're going to be looking to our example. And so we saw that we've got to grow in our character as people if, as parents, we're going to be good examples to our kids. But the flip side of this is that if our kids are not attached to us, if, for example, they consider their people to be their friends, if they're primarily peer-oriented, if the primary company they keep is their friends, then it's their friends' examples that will begin to guide and shape their character. If you're a parent or a teen, or if you have been around teens, chances are you have had a front row seat to seeing this happen. Because the company we keep, the people we're attached to, the people we consider to be our people, these are the ones who tend to shape our character and our values and our beliefs and our priorities. Well, this has huge ramifications for parenting and for what kind of company parents are for our kids. Let me give you a story about this. I grew up in a family and in a small church community that were what you'd call strict Sabbatarians. And if you haven't heard that religious term, don't worry, it doesn't matter, but here's what it means. The fourth of the Ten Commandments says, "Thou shalt remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Do not do any work on the Sabbath, the seventh day of the week. Keep it as a special day." And so my family and the church that I grew up in believed that we were this was still relevant and still binding for Christians today. And so in my family, the Sabbath was sacred. We didn't work. We went to church. We spent time as a family. And in many ways, this was wonderful. It was a gift. And that's what the Sabbath is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a gift. And so as a kid, I enjoyed it. I didn't question it. But one thing you also need to know is that for our family and in our church understanding, the Sabbath was Friday at sundown until Saturday at sundown. That's what it is in the Old Testament. That's how Jews still keep it today. And so as I got older and I became a teenager, I was slowly pulling away from my parents and I was orienting toward my peers. And what were my friends doing on Friday night and on Saturday, right? They were going to football games and basketball games and parties. They were having fun and I wanted to be with them. This was my social life. Being with my friends was becoming more important to me being with my family and pleasing my friends was becoming more important to me than pleasing my parents. I was becoming peer-oriented. My basic attachments were shifting from my parents to my peers. The company I was keeping was shifting from my family to my friends. And as you can imagine, this caused some tensions and some conflicts within me and also between me and my parents, right? I'm having a little trouble with my microphone here. I'm just going to take a second to get it sorted out so it doesn't fall off. There we go. So this tension, right, between teens and their parents, it's just a basic teenage experience. The details might be different, but it's really common as we get older for the values and priorities that we're raised with to begin to come into conflict with the values and priorities of our families. So it's common. We all know it, right? But here's the surprising thing. This tension, this conflict between competing attachments to parents on the one hand and then to peers on the other is, in a sense, a relatively new phenomenon, like in the last 100 years. Now, let me qualify that, because it's always been normal and healthy that as we get older, we begin to push our parents away a bit, we become independent, we become our own people. That's normal and healthy. It's also always been the case that we're attracted to our peers. We like to have friends our own age. And it's always been the case that bad company corrupts good character, right? This was a Greek proverb over 2,000 years ago. And so if we find peers as we grow up who are bad company, that will affect our character and our priorities, and it will bring us into conflict, chances are, with our parents. And all of that has been around forever. But what hasn't always been around is a powerful, pervasive teen culture that by and large is in conflict with family values and that competes with parental attachments instead of supporting and reinforcing them. You see, through much of human history, teenagers got married a lot younger. They very quickly had real adult responsibilities. They had jobs, they had babies, they had mouths to feed. And also, many teens went to school maybe till 7th or 8th grade. Again, it depends on the century and the culture and all that. But they became apprentices, or they took on mentors in their early teens, so they weren't just hanging out a lot with their peers. They were rather maybe living with an extended family member or in another family, whoever they were apprenticed to. They were taking on adult responsibilities. They were learning a trade or a craft, and they were surrounded by other adults and maybe younger children. And if the adults in their lives had some basic maturity and generally shared the values of their parents, then these teens' new attachments were supporting rather than in conflict with their family attachments. Does that sort of make sense? So what's new in the last 100 years that has radically changed is the growth of teen culture as a real, pervasive, and powerful force. It's been inadvertently caused by things which are good things, like widespread schooling, where we take all the teens the same age, we take them away from their families, and we put them together all day, right? And those of you who teach, you know that's kind of a zoo, and you're the zookeepers. You're always trying to make order out of that chaos, and we're so grateful for you. But teen culture has also been fueled intentionally by industry and business and media that recognized a new market to exploit. And the result is that now how teens dress, and they have their own dress, their own fashion, their own hangout spots, their own music, their own celebrities, and now their own apps, their own social media, their own influencers. And so there's this relatively new in human history and very intense youth subculture reinforced by media and big business, a subculture that often now competes with and competes for the attachments that kids naturally have with their parents and their families when they're young. So again, pulling away from your parents, becoming oriented to your peers, that's always been a thing. But the power and the intensity of peer orientation and the way it often now competes with parental attachments and parental values is now on a whole different level. And so if bad company corrupts good character, then who our kids are attached to, who they belong to, and the company they keep matters a great deal. And so what are some practical applications of this for parenting? What are some ways that we can improve the environment of our parenting? What are some ways that we can improve the company that we are as parents and as a church family, extending that? Let me offer some practical suggestions. The first one might be a little surprising, and that is if you're married and you have kids, work on your marriage. Because if bad company corrupts good character, we have to ask, what kind of company are we as parents for our kids? What are we like to be around? Is there a lot of bickering between husband and wife? Is there tension? Is there strife? Is there stress? Are we as parents nice people to be around? If not, why would our kids want to grow up to be like us if the way our kids feel very often is we are not a happy family? Why would they want to then hang around with us once they're old enough to choose who they hang around with? If we're going to parent well, we've got to start by working on our marriage as a starting place to be a team with our spouse and to create a healthy family environment. So that's suggestion one, work on your marriage. The rest of the suggestions involve strengthening our attachment with our kids. And this is a huge topic. It's way bigger than a 30-minute sermon. There are some great books out there on this topic if you want to dive deeper into it. Ross Campbell's two books are good examples, How to Really Love Your Kids and How to Really Love Your Teens. And of course, grandparents, you have a very important role in this too. And so there's also How to Really Love Your Grandkids. For a deeper dive, there's Gordon Neufeld's Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers. But let me just give you a few low-hanging fruit examples of how to strengthen your attachments with your kids. Hopefully this whets your appetite. And some of these hold for grandparents too. They also hold for those of you who want to be spiritual aunts and uncles to kids in your family or in your church. So here's the second suggestion. Make eye contact. This is simple. Not always easy to remember to do. But when you're talking to your kids and you're disconnected or distracted, or they are, maybe one of you is on a device, and you're not looking at each other, whether you're just asking about their day or you're correcting them or you're trying to encourage them, pause, look in their face, ask them to look in your face, then have your conversation. This actually does a lot to strengthen attachment. Just like, oh yeah, hello, you're a person. We are interacting with each other. We put the phone down for a second. Third, touch base. When they get home from school or from being with their friends, or if they get home first, when you get home, take a minute to be intentional about welcoming them home, about asking how their day went, telling them something about your day. Reconnect, touch base. It just takes a minute or two. And do it even as the kids get older if they resist it. Fourth suggestion, have at least one meal together a day. It doesn't have to be dinner. It could be breakfast or whatever, but at least once a day, try to sit down as a family with no TV on, no phones, no screens, just you as people sitting down and eating together. Albert Borgman is a Christian philosopher who's devoted his life to thinking about and reflecting deeply about modern technology, about the good, about the bad, about the unintended effects technology has on us as humans that we maybe figure out too late, and the role that technology plays in eroding love and relationships, the way that that's done that in Western culture. Fascinating stuff. If you like to read philosophy, it's pretty up there, though. He once said something, though, that really struck me. As he's observed the way that society is heading and the way family and relationships are breaking down and the effects that that's having on mental health, especially for kids, loneliness, anxiety, depression, and also societal strife and breakdown, he's reflecting on all this, watching it happen. And as he looks at it through the lens of the biblical vision of rich community and prioritizing love as the greatest thing Jesus called us to, he sees meals as one of the most important issues for family life today. So much so that he concludes with a striking line, get this, yes, fornication is bad and adultery is bad, but not sitting down to dinner is worse. Wow. Whether he's right or whether he's over-exaggerating to make a point, don't underestimate the importance of regularly having a meal together if you're going to be good company for your kids. Now, I realize it may not feel that way, especially if it's something that's new for your family. I remember when our kids were little, meals were chaos, right? And when they got a little older, one kid would be complaining that another one was chewing too loud, and another kid would be just putting his hoodie up and trying to tune us all out, someone else would be critiquing the dinner that Anne worked so hard to make, and now she isn't enjoying dinner either, right? Family members can be really annoying at times. Or maybe you feel like you've got nothing to talk about at dinner. Not every meal is going to go very well. It takes real perseverance to form a new habit, to get used to it, and to stick in there on the bad days, because there are going to be bad days. This is the long game. This isn't about like something new that's just going to fix everything. It also takes a little intentionality, learning to ask each other how your day was, what was good about it, what was hard about it, and to get used to answering that question. But if you stick with it, over time, it can be one of the most important ways to build attachments. Fifth suggestion. Ask your kids about what they are interested in. Ask them questions about it, not with suspicion, not with critique, but with curiosity. Learn what they're interested in and share with them things that they find joy in. Now, I can tell you that this is hard. For one thing, there will be things that they like that are really bad for them that you need to protect them from. For another thing, some things they like aren't the greatest for them and are totally boring for you. Right? When my kids were young, they were interested in Club Penguin and then Minecraft and Portal and listening to K-pop. And these certainly weren't my things. And at points, I'd have to tell my kids as a parent, hey, you know, too much of that isn't good for you. You've had enough screen time or whatever. It's time to do something else. But I also had to learn not to be too negative, not to be always pouring cold water on their happiness. Because this is what they were into. They liked it a lot. They were super enthusiastic about these games and these other things. And if I was going to connect with them, I needed to share a little bit of their joy in what they were interested in. I couldn't always expect them to be interested in my things because, to be honest, some of my things were pretty boring for them. I think our kids, got pretty sick of hearing me downstairs trying to play U2 songs from the 90s on my electric guitar. I don't know why. I think it's really cool, but they just, you know, K-pop, whatever. Sixth, finally, and this is especially true for those of us who are task-oriented, connect before you expect. It's easy to walk into the living room, if it's anything like our house has been over the years, and find shoes kicked off just inside the front door, coats thrown down on the nearest chair, backpacks open, stuff spilling out all over the floor, and be like, man, this place was clean just 5 minutes ago. Where are those little mess makers? Get over here now and clean this up, right? But let me ask you, if you're a kid and you've been out of the house connecting with other people, and you get home and you're out of attachment with your parents, what are the chances you're going to want to reconnect if the first thing your parents do is fuss at you? So connect before you expect. Some of you are like, yeah, that was my parents. Connect before you expect. Take time to reconnect, to do the things I mentioned, to look them in the eye, to smile, to touch base with them, to ask them for a minute about their day, to express that you're glad to see them home, and then to say softly, by the way, before you do anything else, I need you to put your shoes in the closet and to hang up your coat. Bad company corrupts good character. The kind of company that we are for our kids or for kids in our life, what kind of company are we? Are we working to improve and to maintain our attachment with them? What kind of environment are we raising them in? Are we nurturing their faith in? Are we at least more often than not a happy family, and are we working on that? Because it's hard work. If we're not, our kids, as they grow up, will likely be looking elsewhere for company. And it's those people who more and more will be determining our children's beliefs and values and character. So let's work on cultivating the environment of our family, the environment of our parenting. It's such important work. Amen.